This is the Voice of America, broadcasting throughout the world with live coverage of the flight of Apollo 12. Today, the beginning of the 72-hour return trip to Earth. In just 19 minutes from now, at 20 hours 49 GMT, the main engine of the Apollo 12 spacecraft will be fired to take the ship out of lunar orbit and on its way back to Earth. Apollo 12 is now 172 hours and 8 minutes into its mission, traveling in a circular orbit around the moon at 108 kilometers above the lunar surface. It is nearing the end of its 45th revolution around the moon. At present, on the far side of the moon, out of communications with the Earth. Astronauts Pete Conrad, Richard Gordon, and Alan Bean are making final preparations for TEI, that's trans-Earth injection, when they fire the Apollo 12's main rocket engine. Let's get a first status report now on this critical phase of the flight from correspondent Rhett Turner at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas.
About 3 minutes ago, Apollo 12 disappeared from view behind the moon, and we lost communication with the spacecraft. Pete Conrad said, "Roger, roger, bye-bye, see you on the other side." And by the time he reappears, 31 minutes and 10 seconds from now, the spacecraft should have properly fired its service propulsion system engine, sending the craft looping up away from the moon, slinging out from the moon, so to speak, and beginning its long journey back to Earth. It's a three-day journey in rendezvous with the Pacific Ocean. This burn occurs out of view with the Earth, behind the moon, in order to raise the apogee of the lunar orbit. You want that apogee raised in the direction of the Earth, and you do it on the reverse side of the moon from the Earth. The burn is scheduled to come in 17 minutes and 8 seconds from now. It's to last about 2 minutes with a large rocket engine to increase the speed in lunar orbit from 6,000 kilometers per hour to over 9,000 kilometers per hour. And then it will start moving away from the gravitational pull of the lunar body. We'll report more to you on that in the next few minutes.
The Voice of America's continuous coverage of Apollo 12 will take up immediately following this summary of late world news.
In just a few moments, the Apollo 12 astronauts will blast themselves out of moon orbit and head for home. While on the backside of the moon and out of radio contact with Earth, they will trigger the command ship's bell-shaped engine for 2 minutes, increasing their speed enough to break the grip of lunar gravity and send them on a great arc toward the Pacific Ocean, where they will splash down Monday near the island of Pongo Pongo. The U.S. Senate rejected President Nixon's nomination of Judge Clement Haynsworth to the nation's Supreme Court. Mr. Nixon expressed regret and said he will nominate another man in January. Mr. Nixon, in a statement, called Judge Haynsworth an outstanding jurist, and he said, "I deeply regret his action. I believe the majority of the people in the nation regret it." The president said men of Mr. Haynsworth's legal philosophy are needed to restore the proper balance to the court, and he deplored the attacks against the South Carolina judge. The Senate rejected the Haynsworth nomination 55-45. Some senators had criticized Judge Haynsworth for not disqualifying himself from cases involving his financial interests. Opposition also came from trade union and civil rights groups. The United States has agreed to return Okinawa and the other Ryukyu Islands to Japanese administration in 1972. The agreement was announced in a joint communique following talks in Washington between Japanese Prime Minister Eisaku Sato and President Nixon. Senator Charles Goodell and Representative William Minshall called for a congressional investigation into charges that American troops shot and killed a large number of South Vietnamese civilians in a hamlet last year. The U.S. Army says it is conducting a full investigation into the case, but cannot reveal details because it must protect the rights of individuals who might later be brought to trial. Two Army men are currently under investigation in the case. In Pakistan, three Eritrean terrorists were sentenced to a year in prison for attacking an Ethiopian airliner last June in Karachi Airport. The youths were charged with attempted murder, arson, and illegal possession of arms for attacking the plane with grenades and machine gun fire as it was refueling. No passengers were aboard, but the plane was heavily damaged. The attackers told police their action was an effort to bring the world's attention to their desire for Eritrea's independence. Vice President Spiro Agnew's renewed criticism of America's news media has brought a quick response. In a speech in Montgomery, Alabama, Mr. Agnew deplored the trend toward monopolization of the great public information vehicles and the concentration of more and more power over public opinion in fewer and fewer hands. And he challenged the news judgment and fairness of the press, singling out the New York Times and the Washington Post. Both newspapers denied the allegations that they are monopolizing editorial opinion. American Ambassador Llewellyn Thompson is in Helsinki to join in the U.S.-Soviet talks on curbing the strategic arms race. The former envoy to Moscow arrived in the Finnish capital, expressing the hope that the talks will progress faster than did negotiations on the non-proliferation treaty and on the limited nuclear test ban. The arms limitation talks will resume on Monday. The French news agency reports from Moscow that there are indications a Warsaw Pact summit will open Monday in the Soviet capital. There has been no official confirmation of this, but news of the meeting reportedly came from usually reliable sources in Moscow. Earlier today, the East German news agency reported the departure for Moscow of a top-ranking East German military delegation headed by Defense Minister General Heinz Hoffmann. That's the news. This is John Cooley reporting.
From our Apollo News Center in Washington and from the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas, the Voice of America is continuing its live coverage of the flight of Apollo 12. We're only 12 minutes away now from TEI, trans-earth injection, and the firing of the spacecraft's main rocket engine, a maneuver that will take Apollo 12 out of the moon's gravitational pull and send it back on its three-day journey to Earth. At this point, I'd like to reintroduce our VOA coverage team. Here in Washington, I'll be joined by my colleague Norman Guerin and by our NASA expert Merle Waugh, Director of Program Control in Advanced Manned Missions. And from the Manned Spacecraft Center at Houston, Texas, you will, of course, hear from correspondent Rhett Turner. While we're waiting for further reports from Apollo Mission Control, let's get a rundown on the broadcast bans for this worldwide transmission. Norm Guerin?
This Apollo 12 broadcast can be heard in Europe on the 16, 19, 25, 31, 41, and 49-meter band shortwave, and on 251 meters and 379 meters medium wave. In Latin America, on the 16 and 19-meter bands. In Africa, the 11, 13, 16, 19, 41, and 49-meter bands. We are broadcasting to the Middle East on the 49-meter band and on 238 meters medium wave. To South Asia on the 16, 19, 25, 31, 41, and 49-meter bands. We can be heard in East Asia and the Pacific on the 13, 16, 19, 25, 31, 41, and 49-meter bands short wave. Those are the broadcast bands for the Voice of America's coverage today of the flight of Apollo 12.
We are waiting now for word that Apollo 12's main rocket engine has been fired on the far side of the moon, taking it out of lunar orbit and sending it back on its 400,000-kilometer trip to the Earth. Of course, at present, we're out of communications with the spacecraft, being on the backside of the moon. We will not regain communications for at least another 20 minutes. While astronauts Conrad, Gordon, and Bean still have a three-day trip back to Earth, all of the major goals of this flight have been accomplished. A pinpoint landing on the Sea of Storms, a good beginning on lunar exploration, the setting up of scientific experiments, and the actual learning to live in the lunar environment. The astronauts are bringing back with them two boxes of lunar rocks, each weighing about 20 kilograms each, and another bag, a bonus, containing about 22 additional kilograms of lunar rock and soil. Added to this are the parts of the Surveyor 3 that they're bringing back, That's the television camera, an electrical cable, and the mechanical scoop that was attached to the vehicle. And, of course, there are many reels of color, movie, and still photographs of every phase of the moon voyage. They spent a total of 31.5 hours on the surface of the moon, 8 hours of that time actually walking about the lunar surface, carrying out their scientific experiments and gathering geological samples. One of the most interesting of these experiments came on Thursday, shortly after the lunar landing craft Intrepid had docked safely with the mothership Yankee Clipper. The LEM Intrepid was sent back down to crash on the lunar surface at a point about 64 kilometers from the earlier Ocean of Storms landing site. This crash of the LEM set off a series of vibrations that lasted for over 30 minutes on the moon and was measured back here on Earth by the new seismic package that the Apollo 12 astronauts left on the lunar surface. One scientist compared this to the ringing of a church bell in a belfry, with the reverberations continuing for over 30 minutes. And many scientists, according to our news reports, feel that this will represent a major discovery about the moon. The flight now of Apollo 12, 172 hours and 20 minutes. We're about 7 minutes away from the firing of the spacecraft engine for TEI. Of course, we will not get confirmation of that for another 20 minutes or so. Let me ask our visiting expert, Merle Waugh, about this seismic experiment that took place on Thursday. what were your impressions of this, this long reverberation period?
Well, I believe the expression that was in the newspapers of the scientists that were following this experiment rather closely was similar to how I felt. We were completely startled by the reaction, and I think that this will have a lot of repercussions later on in how we decide and what we know about the moon and how the crust works with its inner core and so forth.
But it, would it lead one to believe that perhaps the moon, the inner parts of the moon are not as stable as we thought?
No, I've only thought about it briefly, but for example, if a similar disturbance was made on the surface of the Earth, you would have the atmosphere there to damp
the cushion,
out the motion.
Yes, that's true.
To damp out
mm-hmm.
the motion. But right. but by virtue of not having the atmosphere, this kind of an oscillation would continue and die out for other internal stress reasons over a much longer period of time. Perhaps it really isn't startling when you think about it, but I think it surprised everybody when it happened.
I was looking at a map of the path that the two astronauts took during their two EVA periods, the two moonwalks of about 4 hours each. And on that second moonwalk, they apparently covered distances up to almost a mile, or at least about 1.6 kilometers, over 1.5 kilometers. Doesn't that prove now that man can operate at probably even much greater distances on the lunar surface in comfort?
I would say so. I would say so, and it certainly gives us much more confidence in planning how much work we can expect the astronauts to do on subsequent missions, and probably will greatly influence how we conduct these next operations.
Would that mean an upgrading of the portable life support systems for more distant missions on the lunar surface?
Well, I think we're probably always going to try to do that. For example, the next time we land, if we realize that we can get around this way, we will start out earlier and make a greater distance just by virtue of the fact that we know we can do it.
Rhett Turner, you're in Houston, and I believe you're with us now on our broadcast line. We see in some of the news reports that for the lack of a screwdriver, we didn't have television. Have you heard any reports on that, that if the astronauts had had a screwdriver, they might have repaired that broken television camera in the lunar module?
Some of the engineers who work on the camera commented 2 days ago that if the astronauts had had a Phillips head screwdriver or just a small regular screwdriver or even a pocket knife, they might have opened up one little panel on the side of the camera and clipped an automatic light sensing device, which adjusts the aperture mechanism electronically on the camera. If they could have clipped that out of the circuit, they might have restored it. The general consensus of the
Your syntax ready there.
Yeah, I'll get my ear... I'm hearing my voice bounce back about a half a second later here.
And you're not even on the moon.
Yeah. No, if I can get my syntax right. The Westinghouse engineers generally believe that pointing the camera toward the sun is what probably caused it to malfunction. This automatic light aperture device circuitry in the camera probably was... harmed, and possibly a screwdriver and a knife to clip a wire on the thing could have fixed that. I was going to add something else on the excursion of the moon. When the astronauts got back in, when Conrad and Bean went back into the Intrepid for the last time after that excursion of over 1,500 meters, they still had about 2 hours of life support time left in the backpacks. And it's quite possible that with the PLIS, the portable life support system that we have already, even without enlarging it, the excursion time could have been extended considerably longer. They were out for 4 hours using those plisses, the backpacks. They could have used them up to 2 hours more.
I understand there's some conversation, or some discussion at least, in Houston of, because of this, of extending the moonwalks, the EVA periods for Apollo 13, which is scheduled to come up in March.
Well, as I'm sure Merle will agree, this is the name of the game, is you do something and find out how it goes on one flight, and then apply what you learn to the next one. Project ahead, just as in planning a trajectory of space flight.
I think another advantage of the next flight, we might find the astronauts are not as enthusiastic. It'll be more of a workmanship flight. Maybe we won't have as much enthusiasm, but we may end up accomplishing even more and getting even farther from the landing site.
We certainly couldn't top the enthusiasm of Conrad and Bean.
Did a good job.
A minute and 15 seconds until we expect to have ignition of the service propulsion system engine and the two-minute rocket thrusting by this big engine exerting 9,307 kilograms of thrust to send the spacecraft out of orbit, out of lunar orbit, on the way back toward Earth. I have some other figures at hand here about speeds. Note that at the time of engine cutoff, they should be moving across the lunar surface at about 7,400 kilometers an hour, maybe a little more than that. And then within 45 minutes' time, they will be almost 3,000 kilometers above the surface. They're now 100 kilometers above the surface at the time of TEI, trans-earth burn. And within an hour's time, they'll be almost 3,000 kilometers above the surface.
And they'll be traveling at a...
Here's Apollo Control.
72 hours, 27 minutes. We're 10 seconds away from ignition time for the trans-earth injection burn. Mark, the burn should be starting right now. Yankee Clipper is behind the moon where we cannot monitor the burn. We'll get a report on it when we acquire the spacecraft. Yankee Clipper's weight at loss of signal on this revolution was 34,163 pounds. Should be considerably lighter the next time we see the spacecraft after this burn. Duration of this burn, 2 minutes, 9.84 seconds. According to the clock, we're 50 minutes and 50 seconds into this burn right now. Yankee Clipper's velocity just prior to the burn was 5,320 feet per second. To this will be added 3,042.3 feet per second.
A little faster than we had thought. A later figure.
We'll come back up just prior to acquisition time. We're now 11 minutes and 50 seconds away from acquisition time, given a good burn. This is Mission Control Houston at 172 hours, 28 minutes.
That's Jack Riley. He's the voice of Apollo Control as Flight Director Jerry Griffin directs the trans-Earth burn. Fellow astronaut and scientist, one of the scientist astronauts, Don Lind, is the capsule communicator, and you will hear him in Mission Control talking to astronauts Pete Conrad, Dick Gordon, and Alan Bean. Now, the reason he is on duty at the moment is because after the trans-Earth burn, Don is going to pass up to the crew some of the questions that the principal investigators, that the scientists who are in charge of all of the experiments conducted, some of the questions that they would like to have answered. It's possible that we may still be on the air when part of this questioning period begins. The principal investigators, possibly familiar names to many of you, Dr. Eugene Shoemaker of the California Institute of Technology, Dr. John Freeman of Rice University. Shoemaker is in charge of all of the geological investigations. He's the man who wants to see those rocks that you heard Al Bean and Pete Conrad describing. John Freeman is in charge of the lunar ionosphere detector. Dr. Gary Latham, I believe he's from the University of Maryland, if my memory serves me correctly. He's in charge of the passive seismic detector. He has co-investigators with him, Dr. Maurice Ewing of the Lamont Geological Observatory in New York, and Dr. Frank Press of MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Boston. That is the most important of all of those ALSEP experiments, the passive seismic detector, which you heard Bill McCrory and Merle Waugh discussing just a few minutes ago, the way that the moon was shaken. That's been the big story here in Houston since yesterday afternoon, is the findings of these exuberant scientists.
Yes.
From the early reports coming back and the data coming back from the ALSEP package. 3 minutes, 40 seconds. The burn's over by now. 3 minutes, 50 seconds since the beginning of the burn. It was to last two minutes and 10 seconds, the rocket firing, adding over 3,300 kilometers per hour to the speed of the spacecraft.
Rhett Turner, wasn't there a request from the astronauts earlier on to increase that burn and bring that ship back perhaps a day earlier?
Pete Conrad facetiously, I think, asked... In fact, I may be able to quote him briefly here. He said, that hot engine of ours didn't by any chance buy us enough gas to come home a day early, did it? And when he made that, when he voiced that question, he was referring to the hot engine on the ascent propulsion system.
Oh, on the limb.
On the lunar module, which was a little hotter than it was supposed to be in lifting them up off the lunar surface for rendezvous. But that didn't affect the... command module, Yankee Clipper, and its amount of fuel available. Mission Control said they'd look into it, but of course it didn't affect that any sort of early return or a little faster rocket firing to come home a little straighter. Actually, the path home is not straight. It is somewhat curved, somewhat elliptical.
So it wouldn't do too much in speeding it up, even if we did fire a little more of the gas, as he put it.
They're still not expected to splash into the Pacific Ocean until Monday afternoon.
You know, we were speaking of the importance of the the scientific findings on this journey to the moon, particularly the many geological samples that they're bringing back. Not too long ago, we were at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston and had a chance to go through the what we call the LRL, the Lunar Receiving Laboratory, and which was a fascinating business, a huge building, a complex where all of these moon rocks and the soil and all are very thoroughly investigated scientifically, the various areas of quarantine and even the living quarters for the Apollo 12 crew once they get back here. While we're waiting to regain signal, perhaps we can listen to a brief interview that I conducted with Dr. Purser Bell, who is the director of the Lunar Receiving Laboratory. Well, Dr. Bell, as we sit here in the Lunar Receiving Laboratory at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, we understand that you are completing your work from Apollo 11, moving now toward Apollo 12, when the astronauts will bring back even more lunar samples for you to take care of, as well as the crew itself. First, I'd like to ask you, what are some of the basic things that you have learned in this one experience with Apollo 11?
Well, we have learned that the moon is a place with very low organic carbon compounds, so low that we are much relieved on the problem of the quarantine. We still must maintain it because we are not sure the moon is a very homogeneous place yet by any means. But the level of organic carbon was so low that the probability of life is even more remote than we had thought when we began. That's one thing. The other is now we know the moon is a very heterogeneous place. Before, we had not been sure that the moon was anything like as different from place to place as the Earth is. It still probably is not that different. But nevertheless, it's quite different from one place to another, and the evidence in the samples shows clearly the whole moon cannot be like those samples. It is not, clearly not like that samples from at least three different standpoints.
Well, now, what would you say will differ in the way that you handle not only the quarantine of the Apollo 12 astronauts, but in the lunar samples that they bring back since you have had the experience of Apollo 11?
Well, really, we'll do nothing very different in the way we handle the quarantine or handle the samples. But our expectations of problems will be reduced, you know. Before, we were quite unsure as to whether there might be microorganisms there. Now, we must be careful, and we will be just as careful as we were before. But we are expecting this time that we will not find them. Before, we did not know. Now we expect we won't. We'll treat the samples the way we did before, except even more carefully to reduce contamination. The strain is less the second time than it was the first. We can be even more careful to try to preserve the quality of the samples a little better for the principal investigators to examine.
Well, what do you see as the major problems that you face, particularly in handling these lunar samples? You expect to get a great many more from Apollo 12. We have two EVAs, extravehicular activity periods. Just what are the problems?
Well, in this case, we hope we will get some more sample. We're by no means sure that we will, since there are other things to do this time, like bring back perhaps pieces of Surveyor 3 if we can land close enough to it. So I'm not sure we'll get more sample. We do hope so. We'll just have to be a little more careful about keeping chemical contaminants out of the samples. We would like to save a special sample at which we can be even more careful about the organic contaminants than we were last time. We were fairly successful last time, as a matter of fact. But since the organic level of real lunar material in that sample was so low, we're not sure there was any, we'll have to be even more careful this time to see how low that level is. That level is now so low that it's puzzling. It's surprising there is not more organic compounds in the lunar rocks. There are in all Earth rocks, even a piece of lava hot out of a volcano has more organic compounds than the lunar rocks had. So we don't quite understand. So we'll be more careful, try to locate what the level really is. We'll be careful to keep the inorganic contaminants down so we can do a better job of chemical analysis of the materials. A little more study of their vacuum properties than we were able to do on the first samples, or will be able to do.
Well, thank you very much. Dr. P.R. Bell, manager of the Lunar Receiving Laboratory, and chief of the Lunar Sciences Division. This is William McCrory at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston.
For those listeners just joining us, the Voice of America is bringing you the coverage of the flight of Apollo 12. And now to Houston and the Manned Spacecraft Center, correspondent Rhett Turner.
We're now 2 minutes and 15 seconds until acquisition of signal if Yankee Clipper fired its rocket on time. Now, let me explain again that it's very easy at this point to tell if they fired and if they are heading home because we will see them sooner. We will be in contact with them sooner if all went appropriately. If the main service propulsion system engine did not fire, it will take about 12 minutes more, according to my calculations here, for them to come into view. Here's Apollo Control.
172 hours, 39 minutes. We're 1 minute, 35 seconds away from the time when we should receive Yankee Clipper's signal after trans-earth injection burn. We'll stand by live from now on.
We're not listening.
All of the TV lines are up. It is conceivable the crew could have the TV on at the time they come around the moon. It's not scheduled for that time, but we're prepared to take a TV picture should the camera be on.
It wouldn't surprise us at all for this crew to have the TV on and ready and for us to possibly see an Earth rise as they come into view, see the Earth out beyond the moon. Trans-Earth Injection, TEI, the main service propulsion system engine, the rocket that's got to work to bring Apollo 12 home. 35 seconds until we should acquire signal.
30 seconds.
We're listening now. We have you tuned in with us with the communications loop, the communication circuit to the spacecraft. Data usually comes in first.
15.
Data usually comes in first to mission control before the voice communication begins. 5 seconds till acquisition. Jack Riley will give us a report, I'm sure. He's the voice of Apollo Control now. We should have acquisition now.
AOS.
Acquisition of signal.
We have acquisition of signal.
That means that the burn didn't go on time. Don Lynn making a call.
Hello, Houston. Apollo 12 and route home.
Very good.
Pete Conrad says, hello, Houston. Apollo 12 en route home. Pete Conrad is reading out the residuals from his burn. His communication is a little weak there. They haven't tuned in on it well yet. That's Conrad's voice in the background, if you can hear it. Reading out the engineering figures from his rocket maneuver.
Roger, 12, we got on time, 2 plus 1, 1, 0, plus 0.7, plus 0.1, minus 14.4, and will you say again, your transmissions were pretty weak on the end.
Roger, fuel was 7.4, oxidizer was 7.7, and the unbalance was plus 50.
Communication
Roger,
a lot clearer.
7.4, 7.7, and plus 50, looks good.
What's happening here is the Earth's tracking stations, they're beginning to fine-tune the signal from the spacecraft. With every minute that goes by here, the tracking station experts should be getting that signal stronger and stronger and clearer to us. Burn went on time. Pete Conrad's comment was, Houston, hello Houston, Apollo 12 en route home. Obviously the trans-Earth injection burn did go well. 3 days to go now until that rendezvous with the Pacific. The service engine has certainly done its job well, performing several plane changes in lunar orbit, putting the spacecraft into a hybrid trajectory on the way to the moon, something new on this flight, never done before. Apparently, Pete and Al and Dick are busy
Apollo
there.
Apollo 12, Houston, if you have a camera out already and plan some pictures coming back, we have a target of opportunity for you. However, if you don't have a camera out, we don't want you to bother to dig one out.
We have a camera out.
Roger, they would be extremely happy if you could get some pictures of high lunar latitudes so that we can get some small-scale mapping. The procedure is as follows. At time 170 plus 05, we'd like you to use the Hasselblad with an 80-millimeter lens, black and white film, f5.6, 250th, and infinity, and take pictures at high latitudes, 3 frames, about every 30 seconds.
Get some pictures of parts of the moon near the poles, the higher latitudes. These are areas which have not been as well photographed in the past by either manned or unmanned camera craft.
Clarify, they want 3 frames together at 30-second intervals.
These are black and white pictures they're being instructed to take.
Time again, would you, please?
Pete asks for time.
Well, the time's not critical. 173 plus 05, which is sort of during the last half of your TV pass. But this is your option.
Okay. You ready to receive TV?
Pete asks if we're ready to receive television. Mission Control seems to be configured. They seem to have the TV...
Yankee Clipper is 426 nautical miles away from the moon now. Velocity, 7,396 feet per second. Weight, 25,289 pounds.
7,000 feet per second, almost 800 kilometers above the surface. When they started out at the beginning of the burn, they were 100 kilometers above the lunar surface. Moving at 7,000 nautical miles per hour, 7,000 knots.
Apollo 12, Houston, we're ready for TV anytime you want to send some down to us.
Moving 7,600 kilometers an hour.
Okay, we're trying to get into a good position right now.
That's Conrad.
The thermal wand is for a little bit later, but we're leaving the moon so fast, we thought we'd better take it.
We're ready anytime you want to send it.
I get the impression of leaving the moon very fast. It seems as though they're going straight up. Now about 800 kilometers above the surface. Moving at 7,600 kilometers per hour in relation to the moon, receding behind them. You heard that request for some black and white still pictures of the high lunar latitudes, a request from scientists on Earth. Of course, most of the manned and unmanned camera-carrying craft of the past have concentrated predominantly on the lunar equator, all the way around the moon, as a matter of fact. And so there are higher latitudes which haven't received very great photographic attention. The burn on time, the service propulsion system engine performing just as it should, it certainly has proved to be a very reliable mechanism on Apollo 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. This is the fifth flight to the moon with this tried and proven system. The lunar module Intrepid. Also the fourth time that men have been into
We're
space.
We're standing by for a TV signal. We have nothing yet.
What we expect to see here is possibly...
And a black and white picture coming in.
And why? We expect color any minute.
It takes 12 more seconds to convert the picture into color through a tape recorder mechanism.
Okay, looks like we're climbing straight up from it.
Pete says it looks like we're climbing straight up. That's the impression Tom Stafford, Gene Cernan, and John Young got. Here comes the color picture.
Okay, it looks like we're climbing straight up from it.
We can see the lunar surface. Mission Control refining this picture, the color purity of it as they're transmitting it. We can see many craters.
Picture in true and living color.
A lunar horizon, almost a quarter of the globe out there. The very pocked thing that is our satellite. Pete's going to move the camera to another window now.
You get the impression that you're on a fast elevator.
They're not going straight up, but it does appear that way. Leaving the moon. Within 10 to 15 minutes' time, they rose from 100 kilometers above the surface to 800 kilometers above the surface, moving at about 7,600 kilometers per hour in relation to the moon. Pete is moving the camera to another window, which seems to have a better view of the lunar surface below. They haven't got it very well zeroed in yet. Transmitting live color pictures of the lunar surface from the command module Yankee Clipper. Unfortunately, the...
We see your view along the Terminator now, although we don't see quite as much coverage as we did before. Now, here it comes in now.
The Terminator, the point where day and night on the surface converge. The shadow, where the shadow turns into dark. the sun shining from the bottom of the picture being transmitted back. They're moving the camera around slightly, and there's the lunar horizon again. The moon on the right, the darkness of space on the left. It looks as though the spacecraft or the camera is slowly spinning, very slowly turning, because we know it's not the moon that's turning upside down all of a sudden. From the present picture, it would appear that the spacecraft is now upside down because the sun is coming from the left and lunar darkness is to the right. Should be the other way around at this point.
12, it really looks like you're climbing out in burner.
The afterburner of a fighter jet. That's what Don Lynn refers to.
You're going out, Don. It doesn't take very long to get some altitude out of that place.
Pete says it really doesn't take very long to get some altitude out of that place.
You've got your look around at the Terminator now, of course, and up towards the north.
I think that's Al Bean.
Al's busy getting black and white.
Nope.
I'm on the 16, holding the TV monitor for Pete.
That's Dick Gordon.
Busy letting you see all this.
That's Dick Gordon describing it.
It looks great.
Al and Pete are apparently working on those pictures of the high lunar latitudes. It's amazing how...
One of the things that you probably noticed on your TV screen is how rough it looks along the Terminator line. And this is, was our impression the first time we passed over it. We said to ourselves, now there's a real rough part of the moon. And the next day when the Terminator moved 14 degrees, we found that the part that was now in a higher sun looked fairly smooth, or at least like the rest of the moon is as you see it. And the part that was now under the Terminator looked like the roughest.
Al Bean.
You get a real feel for the texture of the moon by looking at near the Terminator, where you can see the height of the craters and the mountains and all the many features that are on the moon in more relief.
Roger.
If you point the camera up there towards the north, you can show them a couple of long rills.
That's Al Bean's description.
Roger, that texture really comes through loud and clear on your picture.
The low sun angle really enhances the texture.
That's a report from Al Bean.
The essence of that comment is the effect of the low and rising sun angles on different parts of those trails.
I get, Don, and I had to suppress the first time I looked at the Terminator 2.
That's Pete.
It's really useless for you all to have colors down there because it's pure black and white. And the way it looks to me right now, where we are, looks to me like a moon. And I'm not really looking at the real moon. And, it just doesn't look right. It's so black and white. It looks like a painting. Roger, looks just like a black and white photograph, doesn't it?
Roger, we copy.
Well, it's real enough to think we want to get going the direction I'm going after 90 hours.
Dick Gordon made a comment there, too. You've heard all three of them describing what they see. They say they're a bunch of sailors ready to go on liberty.
Altitude 902 miles.
Over 1,700 kilometers above the surface.
Up at the upper top, I see one rill up there. I don't know if you can see it on your TV camera. It's almost a straight line.
That's Conrad.
It's about, I'm looking at the monitor, and I can't see it on the monitor. It's about 30 of the way down from the top. Horizontally across there, and it looks just almost like a straight line.
Roger, it's kind of hard for us to see it on our screen down here.
Conrad says as they ascend from the moon, it looks
altitude
to be...
Altitude 940 miles.
About 1,800 kilometers.
Velocity 6,576 feet per second.
They're now moving at about...
Can you identify any of the features for us, 12?
7,200 kilometers per hour, slowing just a bit now.
Well, we'll break out our map. You know, our map doesn't go to the higher latitudes and lower ones, but we'll see what we can find that we can point out to you that we know.
Roger.
Conrad is going to dig out his map. We can see one distinct Maria area, right in the center of the television screen, the camera moving around a bit, a darker area coming into view in the lower left, one of the lunar seas. The spacecraft really climbing out fast. We're going right ahead and interpreting those altitude figures as Jack Riley reads them off in nautical miles. We're trying to give them to those of you who use the metric system in many parts of the world a fast interpretation. I hope we're fairly accurate. You can multiply anything you hear in nautical miles by 1.8 approximately. The globe is getting rounder. The lunar horizon is beginning to have a greater and greater...
1,017 nautical miles.
1,017, that means they are...
John, how long did you want us to keep up this photography of the high latitudes? Free each 30 seconds.
Stand by.
Al Bean's apparently taking those black and white pictures of the higher altitudes. He's asking how long he should continue doing so.
We got enough now. Anything you want to give us is fine, but don't push yourself. We're happy with what we got now.
That last altitude above the lunar surface, about 1,900 kilometers, moving at about 7,200 kilometers per hour in relation to the moon below. Some 'The spacecraft, as Pete Conrad said, looks like it's going straight up from the surface.
It's really amazing how much the size of the moon has changed just in the few minutes you've been on the air so far.
Astronaut Don Lynn is capsule communicator. He is a physicist.
I'm looking out my small hatch window to the right, and I can see the moon in the entire sphere right now. We are really moved out.
We sure concur.
I'm not a flight help, Frank. What's our altitude right now?
Conrad's asking Fido to tell them, flight dynamics officers, to tell them what's their altitude.
Now, I think one of the things you can't see in your TV, though, is how the texture of the moon changes the higher the sun angle. And over to the extreme westerly region there, you can see how light it is. And how much more gray and stark it is by the Terminator, but Al said it sounded that way as the Terminator moved across. It all really looks the same.
Roger, that shows up very clearly down here.
He mentioned the westerly edge.
Our onboard computer says we're 109 miles right now.
Apollo 12, Houston, right now you're getting close to 1,100 nautical miles above the surface, and you're coming up about 4,000 feet a second.
Okay, we're reading our distance wrong. We're showing 1,098 miles.
There we have Don Lynn describing or giving the information to Conrad on what the latest figures seem to be from Mission Control. I think I was in error there in describing the spacecraft as upside down. According to Pete's description, they are the northern part of the moon would be at the top of your television screen. The
area
south
that's sort of dark down in the lower corner of your screen is my sea. And it looks, as we pass over, to be one of the about medium-sized bodies that that we see on the Earth side of the moon. The thing that's the most noticeable about it is the fact that there's many craters in it that are all filled up with aquarium material. You can just see the outline of the rim. They apparently were once very big, like a lot of the craters you see over there near the Terminator. Now they've filled up, and so they don't appear so.
The Earth...
down at the bottom of your screen by that little white dot.
Roger, we see it very clearly.
I think I have the orientation
here. We assume that's the Sea of Fertility that's over on the west limb.
Sea of Fertility over on the west side of the curve. Affirmative, says Pete, is the Sea of Fertility. The Earth would be to the left, out of the picture. The moon around farther to the left, beginning to move behind the spacecraft.
Altitude 1,230 nautical miles.
They're now almost a little over 2,000 kilometers above the surface.
Apollo 12, Houston, we show that you're coming up at about 1 nautical mile a second. You're really moving out.
Astronaut Don Lynn telling the spacecraft how those calculations
okay.
are going. Okay, says Pete Conrad.
Inertia.
The back side of the moon from the Earth would be off to the right in the darkness.
We got it on the back side of the moon just before the burn. We only put in 3,000 feet a second, and we were going a little over 5,000 feet a second around the moon, and we were talking about how it didn't seem like very much additional velocity to get to take you away from the moon and head you on back to Earth. But I guess this low gravitational field here will just allow you to not put in a lot escape the sphere of influence pretty readily.
Al Bean's comment.
Right, your velocity is dropping off at about 1 foot per second each second. So you needed all you put in.
The velocity dropping.
Roger, that's a lot less than our velocity dropped off per second when we left Earth. It, of course, was trying to pull us back much harder, and so we ended up slowing down from our 36,000 feet per second much more rapidly. You could look at the computer and see that the velocity was dropping many times that per second.
Roger, we were watching you down here.
Al Bean is making that comment for the benefit of the layman of the world, for all of us watching who aren't engineers and scientists. He's obviously addressing that to
today,
us.
Today, while the picture taking was going on, three of us had the opportunity to discuss what we thought the texture of the surface was, especially because we were interested in our landing area and possibly finding some Copernican ray material, and looking at the rays and everything. And they are quite readily visible from 60 nautical miles. But if you look at them carefully through the binocular or something like that, I think that the difference in texture is so slight when you get actually down on the surface that Al and I had the impression on the lunar surface at our landing site that we just could see no contact difference whatsoever anywhere we went. And I think that as you look at the moon going away, you get that idea. You see highlights and whites and grays. You can see rays and things like that, but they're really not that much difference in color from one another.
That's Pete Conrad's description.
Roger. What about the white and gray differences you saw over around the west side of Higg Crater? Could you see those out over the regional area?
Well, I kind of have the feeling that and Al and I talked about this, that when we were in the right place and our foot tracks turned up the lighter material, and it was still the same material, it's just that hadn't weathered on the surface. And we have the feeling that the ray material is probably the same thing. It's pretty much the same general material, but it came at different times and it's had different amount of exposures or weathering.
Roger.
Some vivid descriptions from Pete Conrad and Al Bean.
Yeah, well, this is, there just didn't seem to be any difference in the colors at all. If you look at any part of the moon at the same time as any other part of the moon. Now, as we started at the Terminator and went around the moon, it changed color from gray to white, finally to brown, and we all sort of thought that was about what it was. And then the next day, it did the same thing. The part that used to be more to the white, now it was the gray because the shadows were over there more as the Terminator moved in that direction. And we weren't able to see, except in several spots, any real large differences in colors. I'll tell you, Pete, can you show them that large crater down there in the lower left hand?
That was Al Bean.
Yeah, Bunner. No, it's way over here on the opposite side of the Terminator.
We can see almost a half of the moon now, the great circle growing more distinct as the spacecraft gets higher and higher above the surface of the moon.
That one, along with the cracks, several craters in the middle, that's a beautiful crater.
Al Bean and Pete Conrad describing their experiences on the moon?
To give us some idea of the color, how would you How would you describe the color of Smythe Sea and the Sea of Tranquility for us, so we'll know how accurate our TV color is?
Don Lynn asking for a further description of the colors in the picture that's being transmitted back.
It's a chalky gray to us.
Chalky gray, says
like
Conrad.
Portland cement?
Pretty much. If there's anything else.
Pretty much like cement.
I want to know whether it's wet or dry.
Dark brine material.
Wet or dry cement?
Would you believe that?
I'm sorry, Rhett Turner. We're going to have to interrupt at this point. We're coming to the end of another special worldwide broadcast in the Voice of America's continuing coverage of the flight of Apollo 12. Astronauts Pete Conrad, Richard Gordon, and Alan Bean are now on their way back to Earth, a journey of some 400,000 kilometers that will take them 3 days. They successfully fired the Apollo 12's main rocket engine to take themselves out of lunar orbit at 20 hours 49 GMT. On Thursday, at 14 hours 25 GMT, they perform their perfect liftoff from the moon. The final event, of course, will be splashdown November 24th at 20 hours 57 GMT. The Voice of America will take to the air at 20 hours 30. This is William McCrory in Washington. This program has come to you from the United States of America.